Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento is facing an ongoing homelessness crisis that touches all ages. As we have shared numerous times on Insight, the county has experienced a 67% increase between 2019 and 2022. And of the 9,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night, and that is a conservative number, 15% of those are families with children. As one of the largest school districts in our area, Sac City Unified has been working to help unhoused students and their families, from free meals over the summer to winter jacket collections when the weather turns cold. But this month, the district is adding a new program that underscores how great the need is now. It's a hygiene drive to collect donations, ranging from soaps to shampoos, toothpaste, diapers, tampons, and socks, as well as much more. Joining us now to talk more about the drive and the ongoing efforts to help those in need is Ashley Powers Clark, the Homeless Education Services Program Coordinator for Sac City Unified. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
You know, each school district is unique, especially when it comes to demographics. So let's start off with the population, the student body that Sac City Unified serves. There's more than 40,000 students in the district.
Absolutely. So we are truly a microcosm of the entire world. So we have, you know, our immigrant communities, our diaspora communities, our Afghan, our Asian, our Black communities. We have really a cross-section of the whole world right here in our city and right here in our district. And our unhoused population is a part of that. And it's, you know, homelessness cross-cuts all demographics, right, all ethnicities. So we see that represented in all of our populations.
Yeah, I remembered when covering the district early on as a reporter, and this is before the pandemic, you know, I believe two-thirds of students are on free or reduced lunch. And now I imagine following the pandemic, obviously with the income and cost of living challenges in our area, which has contributed to a 67% increase in people experiencing homelessness, you know, how has that impacted Sac City Unified, the students and their families?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the free and reduced priced meal population, because it's estimated that about 10% of that free and reduced priced meal population also qualifies as unhoused. So as a school district, we have kind of a broader definition of what it means to be unhoused. So if you are doubled up, meaning you lost your housing and then you're in, you know, you have to go share housing with a friend and you're in overcrowded housing. If you're living, you know, in a place that is not meant for human habitation, so things like cars, tents, you know, train stations, that kind of thing. Hotels, motels, shelters also qualify. So when we think about that larger population, it's estimated that probably in our district, there's probably about 3,500 unhoused students. However, identifying and doing outreach to our unhoused students remains to be a real challenge. So we've seen our numbers go up. So we have about 959 identified in our system. And I took a look this morning just getting ready for this interview, and we're already up to about 1,300 just in our outreach efforts this year. So thinking about the unhoused crisis and thinking about how, you know, our numbers have just skyrocketed, where we have, you know, more unhoused people here in Sacramento than we do in San Francisco. And a significant portion of that population, right, is our children and families. And those children and families, you know, it's our responsibility to try to get them to school every day and make sure that they have the things that they need to succeed. School is really... It is a saving grace for unhoused families, right? It is a point of stability that even if you lose your housing, right, you can still, if you can stay connected to your school, we are able to serve those families in some really profound ways. So, you know, maintaining connections to your friends, to your teachers, getting breakfast, getting lunch, and you can also qualify to get supper. You can stay in the after-school program and be in a safe place for 10 hours. So I truly believe that, you know, of all the institutions in the school district, we are just so well situated to be able to have a real impact on these families' lives.
Yeah, it is so much more than a classroom and academics. You know, they're really like the nucleus of communities when it comes to schools. How long have you been involved with serving some of the most vulnerable students, those experiencing housing instability or experiencing homelessness within Sac City Unified?
Yeah, so I've been with the district for about 7 years, and I've been a homeless education liaison for about 11 years. Most recently, I was working really on the ground during the pandemic, trying to organize programs for our unhoused students. So I had the opportunity with some community partners to be involved in sort of the upstart of the Motel Voucher Program, which has been an incredible success and such an asset for our families. I've also worked, you know, as an organizer for unhoused families. I really believe that we are each other's best resource. So in that regard, I've helped to organize a program with Alchemist Community Development Corporation that where volunteers bring families boxes of food every week. So volunteer drivers go out into the community and take five or six boxes to families, some of whom are unhoused, just so that we can make sure that, one, we're supporting each other, and two, the most important thing about resources, especially for our unhoused families, is that people have predictable and consistent access to the things they need. So when we can do that direct, you know, person-to-person outreach, it's so incredibly effective. So, yeah, I've been in a professional capacity, been a homeless liaison for a long time, and then also just really have a passion for this issue and have a background in community organizing. So I kind of leverage that just to help us build our programs and strategies.
Well, and that leads me to this drive that we're going to be talking about, because I've heard of like winter jacket collections, food drives, and other programs like that. But this was the first time I heard of a hygiene drive within Sac City Unified. Has this been done before?
It has not been done before, and I would love to say it was my idea, but it wasn't. We have an amazing communications team. So Nikki, our community engagement manager, just, you know, and this is the thing, like when people hear what you're doing and they hear about your population, the more conversations we have about this, everybody's ready to dive in and support. And that's exactly what happened with our communications department. So she said, hey, do you have the bandwidth to do a hygiene drive? And we were like, absolutely, please help us make it happen. Because when we think about hygiene items, it might not necessarily come to the fore. You think about, you know, clothes, or you think about food. Hygiene items are so critical because parents take pride in what their kids look like, right? We see our kids as a reflection of us. And so enabling families to be able to have clean clothes, to be able to make sure your kids' teeth are brushed and their hair looks nice when they go to school, that's so important to our families. And it's so important to our children. You know, one of the things that we don't think about is that importance of having dignity. So how do we help our children and families show up to school, even when you're coming from these impossible situations, show up to school and have a sense of dignity in who you are and how you look? Because when that doesn't happen, you know, the results can be so difficult for our children. You know, kids get bullied. They get bullied. It happens. And if you don't smell good, or you look dirty, or you look different, you know, kids are going to pick up on that. And kids are wonderful. I love them to the bottom of my heart. And they, you know, and they're also learning how to relate to one another. And sometimes those things happen.
It can be rough.
Yeah, it's rough out there. So I think that the hygiene drive can help us address this really critical need. You know, as a department, we literally can't keep these things on the shelf. They're going out to our school sites in large quantities all the time.
We're going to listen to two parents who are benefiting from, you know, this hygiene drive and other services that the district is offering to families that are facing housing instability or experiencing homelessness. You know, how did you get them to open up and be vulnerable? Because, you know, when talking about, you know, something as difficult as having housing instability, you talk about the dignity aspect. You know, people don't always want to open up and share that part of their lives. How did you get them to talk?
Yeah, so the families that you're going to hear from are families that we have connected with and have been supporting for years. One of the things that we help to assure families is that, you know, being homeless is not a crime, that there is welfare and institution codes that protect you from being reported to CPS, because that's a huge fear that a lot of our families have. So honestly, it is one phone call, one act of support at a time, and over a long period of time, you can build that relationship and that trust. And that's what we hope to do with all of our families. But these two families that you're going to hear from, you know, have really special and unique stories.
Well, let's start with Tiffany McDaniel. What would you like us to know about Tiffany?
Tiffany is she's an amazing, resilient human. Right now, she is unhoused. She has 4 school-aged children and is a single mom, you know, living in an RV. And I think the important thing to sort of foreground about these stories is that oftentimes the causes of homelessness, we think in the grand scale of like, oh, rent is going up and we know how expensive things are. But in each of these cases, it was a tragedy that led to these women becoming homeless. So in the case of Tiffany, you know, her husband was killed and then she didn't have money to pay her rent. And so she literally just up and left with all of her kids and bought an RV and is still there today.
Let's take a listen to Tiffany describing just the challenges about getting her kids to school clean.
Yeah.
If my kids went to school every day, because it's hard trying to get to and from school, being homeless. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't want to send my kids to school dirty. I don't want to send my kids to school in dirty clothes or smelling funny. Like, that's not me.
And that really underscores, Ashley, you know, as you're talking about, you remind us about, you know, school is a wonderful, stable place for a lot of families, but it also can be rough for kids, you know, when you talk about getting bullied, as well as just wanting that dignity component. And so Tiffany really underscores what you were explaining.
Yeah, absolutely. Just that importance of, right, of presenting her children in a way that reflects who she is.
Yeah. Let's also take a listen to Tiffany. I mean, you mentioned that her partner was killed. And so mm-hmm. that really was the precipice of what really catapulted them into homelessness. So Tiffany was describing how she was forced to leave her previous life and just everything behind.
Mm-hmm. I can't pay the rent. I'm out of here. I left everything. Everything that I worked hard to get, my bedroom set, their bunk bed set, their clothes, their everything, everything. We got in the car and left with what we had on our back. And so we had the motorhome, the canopy thing that goes out for the outside where so you can be outside when it rains, fell off, the door fell off. So now we just have the screen door. So I just parked my truck right against the screen door and I let the kids go inside and sleep, and I'll sleep in the backseat of my truck. And I decide normally to stay up all night and make sure my kids are okay. And then when it starts to get morning time, I'll go to sleep.
She stays up all night.
Yeah, I mean, when you have an RV that just has a screen door on it, I think, you know, as a mom, you want to be that physical protection for your kids. And so she's on watch, she's on alert all night, making sure her kids are safe.
You know, oftentimes, like, there's a moral component can be attached to people experiencing homelessness. But I think what people need to understand as well, like, especially in Tiffany's case, and this is just one example, like, there are a tragic set of circumstances. And I've had these conversations multiple times on Insight. Just, you know, it could be a medical bill. You know, it could be a car repair. It could be, you know, just something that seems inconvenient that can really be like the camel that broke or the straw that broke the camel's back.
Absolutely. And when you see particularly our unhoused populations, but then also just our community in general that we serve in Sac City, those safety nets are so fragile, right? And so, you know, not only public assistance and even, you know, food stamps, CalFresh right now is not going as far as it used to. So we saw our COVID benefits get cut from CalFresh, and now grocery prices are really high.
Inflation, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think all of those external circumstances are stretching that safety net so much that it's breaking, you know? And then, you know, our unhoused families, they also, it's like those, they have family, but the family they have, they love each other, but they may not have the concrete resources that you need in those types of crises to help stabilize a situation.
The next family we're going to meet is Alicia and her children. How did you come to meet Alicia? What would you like us to know about her?
So I came to know Alicia because I was I had the privilege of doing parking lot duty at the elementary school, Oak Ridge Elementary School I used to work at for 5 years. And it was obvious by looking at their car when they were coming in the parking lot that they were unhoused. So they were very skeptical to work with us at first. We had to build trust with the family. And a lot of times that trust just happens from a concrete resource like, hey, here's a gas card, you know, come back tomorrow. Pull over. Let's see if we can talk. And those things happen slowly. So eventually Alicia was able to open up and trust us. And Alicia is, you know, she's a single mom. And right now she's living with her 3 school age children and had spent a significant amount of time living in an SUV with those children, you know, parked right outside, you know, parked right near the school at a park.
Yeah, and Alicia talks to you about how she became homeless, unhoused after going through a traumatic car accident.
In 2020, I was in a real bad car accident. August 1st of 2020. Before then, I was working, just self-sufficient, you know, And I was hit by a drunk driver that left me in a coma for a whole month. Everything on my right side was broken.
I mean, you just think about that. And I think about the time when that happened as well, August of 2020. And it would probably, I would imagine, be even more difficult to get connected to those safety nets, you know, when that happened, as well as a single parent with three children.
Yeah. And in that case, from the school's perspective, it was like we hadn't seen her kids, you know, and in that time it was that we had to log on to school, but we hadn't seen them for months. And so eventually when they got stabilized and they were placed in a ground floor apartment, we were able to do some research and figure out what our research means. Like, we just talk to people in the community or go house to house and try to find people. So when she came back, when she was reconnected to the school, it was, you know, it was a relief for us knowing where that she was still. That she was there, you know, because a lot of times with our unhoused populations, it can feel like these kids that you really care about just disappear, and we don't always have connections with them. But yeah, in the case of Alicia, you know, she was moved from her second floor apartment where she was working and paying the bills, you know, and self-sufficient, as she said, and it was just one car accident, right? One tragic car accident that turned her whole life upside down. So she was placed in a ground floor apartment because she, you know, had some significant just physical damage to the right side of her body. And from there, it's like you're no longer able to work in the same way that you used to be. And so then all of a sudden, the income that you have is, right, your disability check, maybe your CalWORKs, maybe your CalFresh, and that's just not enough to make it. And so you see now, now you have a woman with a disability who has a child with a disability, three kids with, and three kids living in that SUV because that's the only option we have. Mm-hmm. She had, and she is in the city's motel voucher program right now. So that was an incredible asset in this situation, just being able to get her out of the car and off the street and into that motel room.
Well, let's listen to also how, like, the programs that the district offers, how mm-hmm. that has really been just transformative for her and her children.
The program was so beautiful. It made it hard not to have your kids at school. I mean, that it's like accommodating, like, in every way. You got your food, you got your necessities, you got a whole food locker in there, from water, from clothes, to socks, to just the whole everything. It makes it hard not to stay linked in with your school.
So that brings me to the hygiene drive, and I think it's important to end with this. If people want to donate essentials at the Cerna Center, which is part of the district, it's on 47th Avenue, what should people bring?
Honestly, we need everything. So everything you could think of that to keep your kids clean. So shampoo, conditioner, lotion, diapers, baby wipes, deodorant, toothbrushes, toothpaste. I mean, go through your morning routine, look at what you do, and know that everybody else wants to do the same thing for those kids. So we're hoping that people can donate, and that we have a big blue bucket out at Cerna. We're hoping that is overflowing because those things, they really help. You know, you mentioned the homeless services program. We're really in this space of trying to adapt to this new reality, which is, you know, homelessness on a scale that we have never seen. And so it begs a question of a school district, and it begs a question of us as a community. How are we going to change in this moment, right? How are we going to adapt to the new reality that we see? And as a homeless education services office, we serve as the hub to distribute you know, clothes and food and hygiene items. We also help to coordinate transportation with students. So if you get displaced from your school, we coordinate transportation to make sure that you can stay there. So we're really kind of the hub that's helping to organize these services and these programs. And so it's critical to donate to our program, especially at this time. And also just to get involved in general. You know, we always need volunteers to help bring food boxes to families, to help us organize. Organizing a clothing closet is a huge effort and a real big resource for our families, so we need people to get involved with that. You know, the best things, we are the best resources in our community, each other, as, you know, person to person, organization to organization. And so, you know, I really believe that by building these, you know, networks of mutual assistance, that's the way we're going to adapt and survive, you know, this new reality, because because it is, you know, we want to do more than survive. But for a lot of people, it is just about survival on a day to day.
Takes a village. And thank you so much, Ashley, for being part of that village.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Ashley Powers-Clark is the Homeless Education Services Program Coordinator for Sacramento City Unified School District. And we have been talking about their ongoing hygiene drive. You can drop off hygienic essentials at Cerna Center. That's off 47th Avenue through December 22nd. And we have more information on our Insight page as well. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Looking back at 2023, there are two sports that you probably heard a lot about this year. For adults, pickleball was certainly a favorite. Lots of people taking up the sport for the first time. But for teen girls, hands down, it probably was flag football. For the first time ever, flag football was sanctioned as an official high school sport earlier this year in California, with schools and their communities embracing the addition. This season kicked off early in the fall semester and became an instant hit. At the start of the season, we spoke with the varsity girls flag football coach at St. Francis High School, Melissa Trewasser, and Will DeBoard, who is with the CIF Sac Joaquin section, about the explosive growth of the game. All right, well, I want to start with you. Take us back to the beginning of girls flag football in California. How did it begin and become an official high school sport?
Well, CIF is a federation. We start everything from the bottom up. So it starts with a school. It starts with literally one school, goes from their league to a section. California is split into 10 different sections as far as high school sports goes. And the Southern section out of Southern California, pretty much every school south of the Grapevine is a member of the Southern section. It's about 600 schools. They proposed, let's have girls flag football in the fall. And this happened in October was the proposal. February, it was approved. And here we are today. We're playing games.
Yeah, that's a pretty fast turnaround.
It's a really fast turnaround. I mean, we've had new sports happen in the past. Beach volleyball, lacrosse, field hockey, et cetera. And, you know, beach volleyball was our last new sport. We have, I think, 8 or 9 schools that are participating in that. Flag football started in February. We immediately had a lot of schools start raising their hands. And we have 70 out of our 180 full member schools playing flag football this year. And we're probably going to be over 100 next year.
Wow. Well, Melissa, you're a part of that. I mean, you've coached basketball before. So how did you get involved in girls flag football?
Well, you know, I grew up playing basketball. I started coaching when I was 16 locally in the area. It was definitely the sport that I love to participate in. But I have been a football fan for as far back as I can remember. The story that I always kind of tell when people ask me how I started pursuing this position was all of my friends when I was a little kid were Saturday mornings watching cartoons, and I was watching Notre Dame football on NBC. So it is a sport that has captured my heart. And then going to TCU, which has a great, successful football program, just kind of reinvigorated that love for the game. And honestly, it's not something I ever thought I'd have the opportunity to coach. And so when flag football was announced, when the rumbling started earlier this year and even last fall, I was in our president's office. I was in our athletic director's office the day it was made official and just saying, I want this job. This is something I want to do on this campus at this school. I think they thought I was kidding at first, but I can be very persistent. And just kind of kept beating down the doors of I want to be a pioneer on our campus in this area for this sport, to bring something that I love and I'm so passionate about to the girls of California that are, you know, participating in so many other sports as well.
And TCU is Texas Christian University, right?
Correct.
You know, given that you're one of 70 schools, which is now going to grow, you know, come next year, you weren't alone in this. What kind of response have you received from girls at your school about wanting to do flag football play?
Well, we had at one point almost 100 girls registered for tryouts. And, you know, it was interesting to see because I think there were all different levels of kids that came in of, oh, is this a club? Is this something fun? Is this powder puff? To, hey, we want to compete at a really high level for a varsity sport. And so we ended up, we have a full varsity squad, a full JV squad. I think I've got 53 girls rostered in total right now this year. And I have girls every single day that come up to me and say, man, I wish I was playing and I want to play next year and I can't wait to try out next year. And so the response at St. Francis, which is interesting because, as you know, the only all-girls school in the area, them wanting to be a part of this, despite the fact that we don't have, you know, tackle football on campus, I think is really cool, as they see a chance to bring something that's never been done on our campus to our campus. And our president, Dr. Fadia Desmond, came out to one of our practices, and after, she said, you know, Melissa, I never thought there'd be a day that I would see football being played at St. Francis. And yet, you know, here we are with overwhelming interest, overwhelming support. The girls love it. Their friends are coming out supporting the games. Their families are a part of it. The teachers, everybody's been so behind it. It's been really cool to see.
If you build it, they will come. Different sport.
Yeah. Exactly.
But it still works.
Yeah.
Okay. So given that the response has just been overwhelming at your one school, and you're saying, Will, that this is going to be growing to more schools come the next academic school year. You know, Melissa touched upon, you know, there's been powder puff for years and decades, mm-hmm. for generations, and there have been instances where there have been girls who played high school tackle football. So what took so long to get flag football approved?
You know, it really came down to interest of the schools. You're right. Powder Puff has been there for quite some time, and there was never any sort of organization there. Generally, it was something that was played during homecoming week more than anything else, and it was a one-off. Usually, you know, juniors and sophomores versus freshmen and seniors, you know, that sort of thing. But a lot of our really small schools that don't have tackle football, they've been playing flag football, boys and girls, for quite some time. A lot of our Adventist schools, and these are schools across the state that have been doing this for some time. Tackle football, you're right. There have been girls who played tackle football. Fair or not, it's been a little bit kind of a novelty. It's been viewed that way. You know, I kind of don't think that's very fair. There have definitely been some very good girls tackle football players out there, but certainly size becomes an issue. You know, those boys get pretty big, that's for sure. But as far as flag goes, this is something for girls specifically. This is their chance to be in the spotlight. And it certainly has it is unprecedented how many schools have been interested in doing this, and the crowds have been great, and there's just so much excitement out there. I've been at the CIF Sac Joaquin section for 15 years, and I don't remember a new sport having such excitement as flag football, that's for sure.
Just out of curiosity, given that male peers, you know, have the option of tackle football, did CIF even consider tackle for girls in high school?
Not really, not so much from a boys and girls standpoint. Girls are definitely allowed to play tackle football, and actually, by our rules, a girl could play flag football and tackle football at the same time. Probably not going to do that because they have their own way of going. Also, tackle football is a fairly physical sport. You know, we do have a lot of, you know, we have a lot of rules in place. That's for sure. But I don't think if we didn't have tackle football and it hadn't been a part of our culture for quite some time, I don't think at this stage we would be adding a physical sport. Mm.
Melissa, given that you had such an overwhelming response from students, you know, what has the reaction been from parents and other adults?
I just think that overall the support, not just at St. Francis, but we've seen it at other stadiums as well, has just been so positive. You know, and I don't want to drill this down to girls and their dads, right? But one of the coolest things that has happened is that so many of these dads, we have dads that played the high school level, the college level, and even the professional level have come up to me and said, man, for the first time ever, my daughter came and sat down next to me on a Saturday to watch college football and was asking me questions and wanted to know more about the game. Or I had one kid came up to me and she was like, I went to the Jesuit football game last week and I've been going to these games for years and never paying attention. And I wanted to watch the game for the first time ever. And I just think that there is such a place for women in football. And I think we've seen the NFL do it, and they're trying to reach a female audience. I think we've seen college is making went to school, it's part of the Big 12, and what they're trying to do to bring more women into the game of football. This has been an untapped market for so many years and decades, where now there's more of a reason to want to get young women involved and passionate about the game. And so from a business perspective and the adults in the room there, from a parent perspective, from a staff perspective at my school, it's been really cool to see everybody kind of jump on board and say, this opportunity is long overdue, even though it's not something that was really thought of, but to let our young women have a chance to be a part of something that is such a cultural phenomenon in this country. And I spent so many years in Texas, so I feel like I can really speak to that, right? But for them to get kind of captured up and the just the fun and the excitement and just the culture of the game of football, I think is a really incredible opportunity for our students, for our young women. And I think that the adults in the room certainly have recognized that that's why it happened so quickly to bring the sport to the forefront. And that's why I think it's going to continue to grow over the next several years.
So what I'm hearing from you, I mean, St. Francis is an all-girls private school, but you're also seeing this enthusiasm across the section at co-ed and public schools.
Oh, absolutely. The crowds for these games, as Will said, have been really, really great. When you look at the teams in our league, we're part of the SFL, which is such a great league for all sports and such an amazing thing for us to be a part of. So Del Oro and Folsom have these just rich, incredible, Granite Bay, just football histories, tackle football histories, and the response at those schools for the girls to come out and play, I think, has just been equally as exciting and enthusiastic. You've got all these, I was talking to Will before about all these old school football coaches, all these guys that have been around for, have coached in hundreds of games, have been a part of these tackle programs for decades. Now they're coming over and they're wanting to coach the girls and they're wanting to get these young women to fall in love with this game. We're seeing it grow at the collegiate level. There's a handful of NAIA schools that are participating in flag football and offering scholarships. I think there are a couple of young women in Illinois that received the first ever scholarships for college football. And when you were kind of asking about why not tackle, I think one of the things that makes flag football so successful, there's not really a financial barrier to starting the sport. And I think that's one of the reasons, too, we're going to see a football program is incredibly expensive. When you look at the equipment, what it takes to do the fields, all of the gear that that football players need to wear, flag football is relatively inexpensive in comparison to that. So it's a really easy sport for a school to add. There aren't a ton of barriers for any school in the section to be able to add this sport. Most of these schools, if you're a co-ed school, you have the facility already. You have a football stadium. For us, we're playing on a soccer field, but it works and we love it. It gives us a little home field advantage. But I think that's why it's going to continue to grow at the collegiate level, at the high school level. We already have our feeder schools and the parochial leagues that are playing flag football at the middle school level. So there is a solid foundation here, but there's so much room to grow. And it's very, very accessible for schools to add this in the future.
Yeah, given that football has been traditionally, male dominated, I mean, that extends to coaches as well. And you're just one of a handful of female coaches for girls flag football. What does that add to this, especially being the inaugural year?
It's something I've thought about a lot, and I think it's something that I take on very personally. It's really important to me, especially being at an all-girls school. We've had a tough couple of games these last few days, and the imposter syndrome as a woman in this sport can be very real. But being a part of an all-girls environment where so much of what we're trying to do at St. Francis is remind our young women that they belong in every space. That they can do whatever they set their mind to, that there should be no barrier based on the fact that they're female. And I'm finding the girls remind me of that. and in this time where I feel like, man, like so many of these coaches have so much experience around the game of football and understanding the intricacies. And as much as I've studied and, I've covered TCU for a decade as a credentialed media member. And so I feel like I have, more insight than just someone watching the game. I still feel like there's so much I have to learn. But But there should be more female coaches in this arena. There should be more women seeking out the opportunities, not just at the high school level, but the collegiate level. We're seeing it at the professional level even. It definitely feel a responsibility to be successful, to carry forward the dream of women that want to coach football. This has been my dream since I was a little kid. When I got hired, our SID at St. Francis found an article from 2009 when I got hired to coach varsity basketball at Granite Bay, where I was asked by a reporter for the Press Tribune, if not basketball, what would you say? What would you want to be doing? And I said, I would want to be an offensive coordinator. I've wanted to do this for as far back as I can remember. And so I want to be successful for my team, for my school, for my program, but also just for, you know, the women that want to do this in the future. Like it does feel like an added responsibility and an added pressure, but it's something that I'm so proud to take on and be a part of, especially being part of an all-girls school community.
Yeah, going from the stands to the sidelines as a coach on the field.
Yeah, it's been it's been a lot. I mean, it's been a big learning curve, a learning experience, but it's also been so much fun.
Yeah.
I can't even express just the joy that being a part of this sport and being able to help pioneer something new in the state has brought me, and how exciting it is to get to be part of the foundation for something I think is going to have a long, long lineage in California and across the country, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Okay, well, if you are in the audience and you're mm-hmm. going to be watching girls flag football, are there differences between, you know, the high school football that we've been used to watching?
Well, the number one, the field's a little smaller. It's 40 yards by 80 yards. So it's about two-thirds-ish of the football field. Not a lot of running is allowed. This is a passing game. A lot of mobile out there. And obviously, not a lot of contact. But what it looks like... Looks like what we all grew up playing. I mean, I grew up playing flag football at junior high 35 years ago. Hard to believe. But I think a lot of junior highs, they don't play tackle. A lot of them play flag football. And you've seen it a lot. And I do want to second what Melissa was talking about. We have a lot of schools. We have a lot of schools playing flag football. I think you're the only female coach that I know of that's
wow.
out there. I mean, there aren't many. I mean, pioneer is the right word here.
Yeah.
It really is.
What has been some of the biggest surprises for you, Melissa? I mean, you have been a longtime basketball coach, but were there key differences when now coaching flag football? What has surprised you most? And just, you know, we're just weeks in.
Yeah, you know, there have been a lot of things. I think the speed of the game is really, really great. It's one of my favorite parts about it is how fast this game plays. You know, I think when we looked at the rules and what it was going to be like, we thought, oh, yeah, this will be pretty fast. But it is a fun game. And I spent a lot of time in Texas. I'm from here originally. But I've seen a lot of 7-on-7 because that's what they do in the offseason, you know, and everything. The way the boys play 7-on-7, not nearly as much fun as the way the girls play 7-on-7. That's a hill I will die on. It's a blast. But I think is, you know, while this is not a tackle game, it's why it's not a physical game, the girls play with a physicality and with a strength that I don't know that I want to say it surprised me because I've been around enough female athletes, but the competitiveness, how serious they're taking, I think that at first I was like, well, I don't know, like, are they going to be a little scared? Are they going to pull back? No, these girls have jumped in with both feet. They are so excited to be football players. They are so proud to be football players. I think that it's amazing to me just how much girls had desired more of these opportunities to say they are part of a football team and how seriously they've taken it. You know, St. Francis is very competitive. That is just like a part of our DNA and across everything. But even I have been surprised at just how much these girls have invested in this and how excited they are and how often I had one of my players' moms email me this week and was like, oh, she's an equestrian athlete and she was at a competition and she just couldn't wait till everybody she was playing flag football too.
Melissa, and well, we got to leave it at that. It was so much fun. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
Thank you for having us.
And that was my conversation with St. Francis High School's Melissa Trebwasser and Will DeBoard, who is with the CIF San Joaquin section. And they're talking about the inaugural year of girls flag football as a sanctioned sport in California. This first aired at the beginning of the school year. And Will tells us that next year, at least 20 more schools will be adding flag football. That includes Elk Grove, Modesto, and Turlock school districts, pushing the number of schools in our area with flag football to over 100. Still ahead, it is the season for gift giving. Cap Radio Sacramento newsletter joins us with their list of Sacramento-themed picks from local businesses. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. 6 months ago, Cap Radio embarked on a fun new way to connect with the community. The Sacramento newsletter launched, and the no part is spelt with K-N-O-W at the end, so it's a fun play on words. It's delivered to your inbox every Tuesday and Thursday, and Cap Radio's Claire Morgan and Janelle Salonga offer a more personal and digestible way to stay informed, involved, and of course, entertained. And the newsletter has really taken off. So if you haven't subscribed, we have a link on our Insight page as well, of course, the Cap Radio homepage. And today is a great example of why people enjoy the Sacramento newsletter. Janelle and Claire put a call out to Cap Radio colleagues asking for their favorite gift ideas that are from Sacramento. And we didn't disappoint. This morning, they released their picks of Sacramento-themed gifts for the holiday season. And Claire and Janelle join us now with the unique and pretty impressive list. Good morning to you both.
Hello. Good morning, Vicki.
So I was telling Claire, Janelle, that, you know, I think I'm pretty good at local gifts, but when taking in the list today, I actually learned some new gift ideas to add. Yeah, how fun was the process putting it together, Janelle?
Yeah, it was pretty fun. I mean, we started and kind of just put out a survey to our coworkers to see what, you know, they said, but we also, you know, just talked with them in the office. And together we kind of compiled this list, and a lot of what you're seeing in the newsletter, what you saw in the newsletter this morning, if you got it in your inbox, is actually the words of our coworkers themselves, you know, enthusing about their gift picks.
Claire, how did the idea come about?
Yeah, I love to give Sacramento the focused gifts. I feel like my personality trait has kind of become loving Sacramento. And so especially during the pandemic, when there was the push to support small businesses and local businesses, I started thinking more about how I could support Sacramento businesses. I kind of came up with my own little arsenal. But Janelle and I were talking back and forth about Sacramento themed gifts. And I thought, why not open this up to a larger group of Sacramento experts? So that's how it was born.
So you put the call out. What you received from Cap Radio colleagues, did it meet or exceed your expectations?
Oh my gosh, it totally exceeded my expectations. I got many gifts on the list myself. As the results were coming in, I was ordering things. I think I was ordering things on Black Friday. Like I was really, really excited about what people suggested.
Janelle, what stood out to you about, you know, the picks and the selections that your colleagues made?
I feel like my colleagues and I shop at the same places is maybe what stood out to me, or just like we think the same way. Like when Jennifer Holm, our director of member engagement, said, you know, giving consumables is the way to go because you don't have to worry necessarily about picking the right thing. I was like, OK, we are thinking along the same lines of gifts, because I too love to give, you know, consumables within reason, because it's something that people can enjoy and is something that is both like enjoyable and inherently useful to people. And so I think that was kind of cool to me too, to see that people, there's a lot of overlap in what me and my coworkers consider fun Sacramento gifts. I know Josefina, also from membership, mentioned Beers Books, and that's another Sacramento bookstore I really enjoy. And I also have a tote bag from there. So I also thought that was fun that, yeah, I was amused by the overlap.
Yeah, I mean, when I was reading the list today, I was like so happy I haven't like completed all my gift shopping yet, because I have some fresh ideas to add for to give to people. You know, did you have any favorites, Claire? Things that stood out to you?
Yeah, I loved the suggestion of getting a print from the Sacramento History Museum. Yeah. I actually went over the weekend and got some for people in my life, and I also brought one for you for having us on.
Thank you.
So yeah, that was my favorite. If you don't know, the Sacramento History Museum has kind of a TikTok famous star, one of the docents, and he does a lot of the prints. So that was just so cool to have something that he had participated in, I thought.
And I love that there's something for everyone. Like, yeah, of course, there's edible gifts. There's even some like wine tasting selections. I loved the outdoor world of the Sacramento region. And that came from Rachel, who, of course, is a colleague of ours. And it's a field guide that includes flora, fauna, natural history specific to our area. I had no idea about that. I think that's an awesome gift. So there's something really for everybody.
Yeah, totally. And also, if you're receiving a gift from me, please don't be surprised if something from this list shows up, because you will definitely be seeing some things.
Janelle, did you have a favorite?
Yeah, I also really like the field guide. And I thought Nicole's suggestion of going wine tasting at Bogle was really cool, because I browsed the website after and I was like, wow, this seems like a really cool thing to take some family and friends to. So that if you get roped into a visit, just know it was because of that. It was because of that newsletter gift guide. I also liked our colleague Tony's suggestion of a light the beam nightlight, because I think it's sweet to think let's bring the beam into our house. Start your kids cheering for the Kings early, as it would be.
Yeah, a lot of Sacramento pride, even like a Sacramento Monopoly game as well, which I think Tony recommended also. One was also a book from, you know, our digital editor, Chris Hagen, you know, The Adventures of Mr. McCaw. And that's from a KCRA reporter who I also worked with, Leticia Ordaz, and she actually joined us on Inside. And it's a bilingual children's book. So for all ages, there's a lot of fun stuff in there.
Yeah, and I think that's set in Sacramento, right?
It is. Yeah, awesome. I believe it is, too. Finally, I mean, as we're winding down the conversation, we have a few minutes left. I mean, we're kind of getting, I think next week is probably 6 months since the newsletter officially launched. You know, when you reflect on the last 6 months, I mean, the both of you, as well as others, had an idea, and now you see it come to fruition, and it has grown, and it's really just, people have really taken to it, and they love it. How does it make you feel?
I feel like I can't over-express how happy it makes me. As I mentioned earlier, I feel like it's kind of my personality trait at this point to love Sacramento, and so to almost feel like I have, like, a bunch of friends joining me on that journey, it feels really nice. And it's really great to know how many people care about our community.
Yeah, Janelle, I mean, subscribers have just grown in the last 6 months. It's been awesome. How does it make you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I just also feel really grateful that folks want to come along with us on talking about this place that we both really love. I feel odd when I think about it, because I, you know, obviously we believe in this newsletter that we're putting out, but you know, that there's still a lot of room for surprise, or at least for me, there's a lot of room for surprise, pleasant surprise at how quickly the newsletter has grown, how people have engaged with it. So yeah, I just feel really grateful and really thankful for everyone who's come along with us and who continues to, you know, read the newsletter whatever time they may prefer to read them.
Yeah, of course, you know, because it's in the morning on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but you really can read it anytime you want. When it comes to, you know, for people who are just learning about the newsletter, because it has just been 6 months, I mean, how do you describe it to people when you talk about it to either friends or just people in the community? Claire?
Yeah, I think about it's kind of like someone who's really obsessed with Sacramento, I keep coming back to that point, but someone who's really obsessed with this city and this region, explaining things in a very friendly way, breaking things down, what you need to know, big story of the day. We have some headlines. We also dive deep into a bigger story. And then we also have a spot for joy, where we highlight a prominent Sacramentan or some fact about Sacramento history.
Hmm. Janelle, are there some pieces of the newsletter over the last 6 months that are kind of your favorite and that you hold dear to your heart?
Wow. I think that's it's a big question. There's a lot. I really like The piece that I got to do highlighting Kennedy Gallery in Midtown, which recently closed, unfortunately, earlier this year. And, you know, the pieces that I've gotten to do about the different aspects of history throughout the city have just been, and throughout the region even, have just been fantastic to do. I think, you know, Sacramento is a region that has a lot of rich history, a lot of history outside of just being our capital city of California. And I think that's been one of the really cool things about getting to work on this newsletter, is to highlight Sacramento as this place where people have for many years built their lives, built their homes, you know, and not just, you know, a place where policy gets made. It's also a place where people build families and where policy affects them. So it's been, yeah, I've really enjoyed, you know, everything that helps us talk through and talk about that.
Yeah, and also the, I think a big fan favorite, at least mine too, is the tales and local legends at the end of the email.
Yeah, that's always so much fun to write. I think I spend the most time working on that every single week.
Yep, and today's, this morning, is the Sacramento-themed gift guide. So thank you both so much for giving us your local picks, you know, curated by CAP Radio staff. So we have good taste here.
So true.
Thanks, Claire and Janelle.
Thank you.
Claire Morgan and Janelle Salonga are bringing you CAP Radio Sacramento newsletter. It's delivered to your inbox every Tuesday and Thursday, and they just released their Sacramento-themed gift guide this morning. You can find the Sacramento newsletter on your CAP Radio homepage. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to reach out to us, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.